Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Cutting the Curd has been brought to you by Academy Opus Cassius. The Academy Opus Cassius is the cheese industry's unique center for professional development, offering both practical and classroom training in the heart of France. For more information, visit academy-mons.com. That's academy-mons.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Greg Blaze. I want to give you a little public service announcement before we begin. If you like this show and others on our network, please check out the Heritage Radio Network's Kickstarter. The link is on our homepage. Our website is at heritageradionetwork.org, and it's the table we gather around to share our stories, advice, recipes, music, life lessons, and so much more. We need your help to rebuild a new improved website before the coding language that supports our site expires at the end of the year. Plus, there are some great rewards at each donation level, so please check it out. If you love good food and great conversation, please help us out. And speaking of food and great conversation, in today's episode, I'm really happy to have Lisa Hall of Saxon Creamery on the line. How are you, Lisa?
I'm great, Greg. It's good to hear from you again.
It's always good to hear from you. I always wanted to mention Raw Milk Cheese Appreciation Day was last Saturday. We had a great episode last week about it. I was checking out all the Instagram posts at hashtag Raw Milk Cheese, and it's incredible how many people participated. I know Saxon creates special and several pasteurized cheeses as well, and I think the beauty of the day is the idea of choice. You know, that we should have the choice of what we want to make and consume, given safety standards and such. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Both cheeses have so much to offer for whatever it is that you like.
How did you celebrate Raw Milk Cheese Appreciation Day?
Yep, we sure did. We had a special going on here at the store, and, of course, we did a bit of it on Facebook and just trying to promote the raw milk cheeses, including one of ours, which is Glacial Lakes.
Nice. So Lisa was on the show last spring for episode 174. Definitely check it out if you haven't heard it yet. She talked to us briefly about the alarming decrease in smaller family farms in Wisconsin and her own story of trying to get a loan for a tractor. That's a great episode, and you can find it archived on heritageradionetwork.org. And at the end of the episode, I kind of left at a cliffhanger, and I said you would tell us more about Big Ed the next time I had you on, which is a story you had told me when I visited Wisconsin last year. So I was hoping you could tell us who Big Ed is and how you came to know this guy and to love him and his story.
Sure. Well, Big Ed, one of the things about Edward Klesick, he would be the fourth generation of the Saxon Homestead Farm. He was quite a rebel in his time, but I came to know him probably 8-9 years ago. He had had an accident, and he became a quadriplegic, and he needed someone to take care of him. and I happened to be just down the road. And so the family had hired me to take care of him and take him to doctor's appointments and be his caregiver. And that's how I got to know him. And in the 4 years that I had worked for him, I don't think I met a greater person in my life than him.
Oh, that's amazing. Why so?
Yeah. He stood for a lot of things, and I think the biggest thing is that he really loved the land, and he loved animals, and he loved the environment, and he wanted to keep things as natural as possible.
When you say that he was a rebel in his time, how do you mean that?
Well, one of the stories that he loved to tell, and I don't think anybody ever tired of hearing it, in 1976, there was a proposal for a major interstate highway to go from Milwaukee to Green Bay. And with laying that highway, it was going to interrupt 2,300 acres of prime farmland and woodland. And his property being one of them, that really bothered him. And so his wife and himself took 5 years to fight this proposal. And when they actually started laying down the bed for laying the interstate,
yeah,
he actually laid down in front of the bulldozers.
Nice.
And then he got pulled, he got taken to jail, and then his wife had to bail him out. And immediately they started planning their next fight. So they went ahead and loaded up several milk cows and some fencing, and they went to the capital of Wisconsin, which is Madison, and right underneath the governor's window, they set up a fence and had their cows, and they just waited until the governor would come down and talk to them about this highway and how it was going to really go through a lot of prime land and interrupt a lot of the agriculture in our area.
Did the governor come down and talk to him?
Yes, he did, and actually became quite good friends with Ed after that and years to come. Excuse me. But the resolution after battling it for 5 years is the federal government did agree to reduce the median strips, which would save about 200 acres. And I know it sounds like a small amount compared to the 2,300 acres that they were going to go through. But still, he did win in his little way, and he did reserve, and get 200 acres, that got to stay as a farm.
And then the important thing, it would seem to me, is that, by doing that, he made people aware that their land might may be taken away for reasons unbeknownst to them and powers, greater mm-hmm. than them. Or at least that's how I would
think. Oh, absolutely.
It.
Yep.
And,
yep.
Well, that's a great story. I'm sorry. Please go on.
So I guess when after Ed's passing, the cheese factory really started to take off. And when it came to one of the first cheeses that we made, it was a Gouda style. And when we decided to start to market the cheese, we knew we had to come up with a name. And I recall the family had sat around an old rickety antique table that was in our office here, and they came up with names. And one of the children had said, "Well, why don't we call it Big Ed? Because it's big, it's bold, and it hugs you back every time you're around him." So that's how we got our first cheese. The first name was Big Ed.
Oh, that's fantastic.
In his honor.
Mm-hmm. I like that story, and I like people like that who stand up for what they believe in. I'm glad you told us that. So I wanted to ask you a couple questions.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you about the word sustainability. It's an important word, in the rhetoric around the food movement, and I want to know what sustainable agriculture means for cheese, in your opinion. What are other dairy companies doing to support environmentally sound and sustainable practices, especially around you?
Yeah, that's a really good question because, just in my experiences and working here, I think I've grown to really appreciate some of the things that the Saxon Farm and the Saxon Creamery do to sustain agriculture and make a good product. Some of the unique things that we do is, the farm that provides us the milk, they have a highly efficient and a livestock sensitive, and they're very environmentally friendly. And what some of those things mean is they have about 1,000 acres. They've put 900 acres of that into permanent pastures, and that's what the cows are grazing on.
That's fantastic.
And the benefits of that, which benefit the environment in our community, is that it minimizes the groundwater, the runoff of, of groundwater. It reduces agricultural chemicals and fertilizers and land erosion. And these are all things that Ed Klesick put in place years and years ago. So this family has really been environmentally sound for four generations. And in a process that all reduces our carbon footprint. You know, we're not using gases and fertilizers and chemicals. We're just allowing the cows to graze on natural grasses. They're fertilizing it with their manure. It breaks down, and they have a really rich, rich soil.
Nice. What are the what are the challenges in creating an economically sustainable venture like that, both for your company and for the community around it?
You know, and that's a really good question, because we do have challenges because of our weather. If you have a frost and a thaw and a frost and a thaw, we can lose quite a bit of our pastures and having to retill them and then replant them. Which is what we're trying to reduce, having to till that land and having to, you know, rip it up and things like that. We want to try and keep it as sound as possible or as natural as possible. So weather can be a challenge for us. Other than that, it's about as easy as that. The cows are on, you know, the way nature wanted them to be. They're out there. The extra paddocks, when they're not on pastures, you know, that are further away from the farm, they cut those and they store those feeds for them for winter. So they have, you know, a constant grass-based diet all year round.
Yeah, and it would seem that, I mean, if do you know of other farms that operate that way? Or
we're actually one of the largest pasture-based farms.
Oh, that's great.
And it really has worked for them.
So, in the last episode, you mentioned that you mentioned a solution for the decrease in small-scale farming would be to educate young people about farming. And I wanted to know if you could expand on that a little bit for me, too.
Sure. I really think that we need to get our younger generations involved in anything to do with agriculture, whether it be, you know, farms where you can go to these farms for a summer and learn, like an internship. They do that in a couple farms in our community here. And I think that is just so vital, because they're going to learn everything from, you know, growing crops to, you know, caring for livestock to, you know, being able to figure out what crops you need. And it's an education that needs to be shared from one generation to the next.
Are children out there interested in doing that?
Yeah. You know, we do have quite a few ag classes in our high schools, which is a great thing. I know the Saxon Homestead Farm, they hire, like right now is their calving season, and so they have 360-some calves that have been born since March 1st.
Nice.
And they hire kids to take care of these calves. And all the children that are there, the ages are ranging from 18 down to 11. And they're caring for these animals and learning, you know, life and death, how to feed them, how to care for them, you know, to notice if they're ill or not, and when to move them, you know, from their pens to the pasture. I know that is just so vital.
Are they going to help, you know, this education, is that going to help the decrease in small-scale farming in Wisconsin, do you think?
I really hope so. The sliding scale is there, and I really hope that the family farm doesn't go away, but it does look that, you know, that they're reducing every year. There's less and less of them, and the larger farms are, you know, absorbing their cows. But that's also a good thing too, because, you know, kids can learn that style of farming. It's on a much bigger scale. You still have to have management for the diet of the cows and veterinary skills and things like that. I just think any way that any kid can get into any type of farming or agriculture is a good thing. Our state of Madison, they've got a great Center for Dairy Research when it comes to egg classes and learning how to make cheese and ice cream and veterinarian school and everything. You know, our state is so rich with these things.
Absolutely. It struck me when I spoke to you last, when you told me that, you know, there used to be one or two, you know, there's a newspaper that you talked about that
sure.
comes out, and the amount of people whose farms, I guess, were going under, or being foreclosed on, or up for sale, has increased exponentially. Has that leveled off any since I last talked to you, or do you see it leveling off?
Well, the average farm here in Wisconsin still is about 100 cows, which doesn't seem like a lot, but, you know, there's a lot of family farms that survived and made a good living on 50 cows. So, you know, those are the ones that are not having a generation coming up that want to take over the farm. You know, so our average still is about 100 cows. But there's much larger farms too that have, you know, 6,000 cows.
So those little guys are getting absorbed by the big guys.
Yep.
Now, is that, and you say that you don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing in some cases, because, you know.
No, because we're still keeping agriculture in Wisconsin.
Right, exactly.
You know, the family farm, you know, that business model is, you know, I fear it's going to be gone. But still, if we can keep agriculture in our state and keep the milk flowing and provide, you know, really good cheeses and milk and yogurt, that's all good.
Well, when you say you fear that that's going to be gone, does that also make you worried about raw milk cheeses? Are these larger farms going to pasteurize all that milk?
Yeah. And that, too, I feel that we're losing our raw milk producers. It does worry me that, you know, raw milk is getting harder and harder, one, to buy, and it's also the raw milk cheese producer, I think it's getting fewer and fewer.
Yeah, you see, we had this wonderful celebration on Saturday, and so many people participated in it. And like I said in the beginning, and what I've always felt, and when I spoke to Brad, and while I was here with Ann, it's choice. I think choice is the important way to look at it. You know, pasteurizing milk, in some cases, and in a lot of cases, is necessary and not a bad thing, but when you talk about the small scale farm and it's going to go away or it's going away, it looks like that once you get to a certain tipping point, it's really hard to stop that sort of thing from happening, right?
Yeah, I agree, and that's what I think. You know, that's how I feel. I feel like it's going to be gone by the wayside.
That's a shame.
It is
for me, but thankfully, you know, you guys make some tasty pasteurized cheese. So,
thank you.
Well, we also talked a little bit last week about the health benefits of cheese. You know, and public health is also an important aspect of the sustainability discussion. So, what do you think about cheese as a health food?
Definitely, any type of dairy is good for everybody. You know, they still recommend 3 dairy in a day, and I really think that cheese provides a good source of dairy and calcium. I know specifically for our cheese and the milk that comes into us, something that's kind of unique. The Saxon Farm had made a decision about 8 years ago to do what's called a breeding program to breed A2 cows to produce an A2 milk. I'm not sure if you've heard much about it, but
I have not, but maybe some of our listeners has. Maybe you can expand a little bit about what
that's
about.
Sure. That could be a program all in itself, Greg.
But, I'll have you on as many times as I can.
There is, if you do some reading on it, there is two types of milk, an A1 and an A2. And really, the only difference is one of the beta casein proteins is what the difference is between the two. And the Saxon farm had decided about 8 years ago to only breed their cows to breed an A2 cow. And to them, what that meant is that this is going to be of interest someday. This could be something that we could use as a marketing tool. Because people are going to become more aware of their food and how their food affects their health. And, you know, in those 8 years, they have been doing quite a few studies. I think there's a lot more to learn about it. But some of the things that I noticed is that they're talking about, they just did a study that an A2 milk can help either eliminate or reduce lactose intolerance symptoms.
Ah, that's a big deal.
And that is a really huge deal. If they really continue to monitor that, and there's some truth to that, that would allow people who can't have lactose in any form, they could actually enjoy cheese, or they could actually enjoy ice cream.
Yeah, man, what is a world without ice cream? I do not want to know what kind of world that would be.
I know. But they're also looking at a couple other things. Diabetes, they're doing some testing on, and autism.
Really?
And if it would be so simple as to just a type of milk, that would be amazing.
It sure would. I agree with
you
there.
So I guess that's one thing that, you know, kind of makes us a little bit special. The other thing, too, is our herd, the way they breed their cows, they breed them so that we have a real quality milk. And this milk has a lot more protein and cream. And that adds to the flavor and the texture of our cheeses. Some would say that there might be more calcium in it, but I don't know that study, you know, if that's true or not.
Yeah, but you know the texture and the richness is there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then we also have a lot of character in our milk, too, which comes into play with the way the cows are out on grass, our changes in season, and the type of cows that they have.
Certainly. I mean, I would like to. I need to do a little bit more research on A1 cows versus A2 cows. That's. I find that really interesting.
It is.
Now we're gonna have to take a short little break, but we're gonna come back. We're talking to Lisa Hall of Saxon Creamery.
The Academy Opus Cassius is the cheese industry's unique center for professional development, offering both practical and classroom training for cheese professionals ready to move their careers to the next level. When you come to learn at the Academy, we instill our love for cheese, our expertise, and our experience so that you can support artisanal producers, impeccably care for the fine cheeses you carry, and serve your customers with skill and enthusiasm. We integrate hands-on practice, formal instruction, and classroom discussion in all of our courses. The Academy's programs are offered at the Mons Fromagerie in the heart of France, where cheese undergoes affinage and cheeses are received, prepared, and shipped. Several Mons retail shops are nearby. The surrounding countryside is the home to producers whose excellent cheeses are cared for by the Mons team. The Mons cheese business has more than 50 years' experience caring for and teaching about cheese in France, a country known as the source of some of the world's greatest cheeses, deepest cheese tradition, and the highest level of technological research and rigor in cheese making and ripening. The Academy has been recognized by the American Cheese Society as the first approved education center for those preparing for the Certified Cheese Professional Exam. Enroll now for Essential Foundations for Cheese Professionals or Affinage, the Art and Science of Maturing Cheese. For more information, visit www.academy-mons.com. That's academy-mons.com. Certified Cheese Professional is a registered trademark of the American Cheese Society.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Before the break, we were talking to Lisa Hall of Saxon Creamery. I wanted to take this opportunity to congratulate you, Lisa, on your 2015 U.S. Championship Cheese Contest win. For those of you who are out there, Snowfields took first place in open class and made it to the Sweet 16, which is the top 16 cheeses in the United States. It's a great accomplishment. I know. And then the last time you were on the show, I was eating Snowfields while you were on the air. So congratulations to you for
that. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we really appreciate it. It was very humbling to be there, and it was just a very exciting night to be able to see that our cheese was recognized.
Let's get some good stuff. I mean, it's like I remember when I was visiting you in the creamery, and I tasted it. I was like, I just have to have this, and it's so easy to eat. It just appeals to all palates. And I really, you know, congrats on that, and you know, and I'll always be carrying it. And
Thank you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So we didn't get to talk too much about Saxon Creamery in depth the last time you were on. So I would love to take the opportunity now just to talk about Saxon, you know, which you had mentioned before is a fifth generation Wisconsin family farm in Cleveland, Wisconsin. And you use only milk from your pasture-based herd. So can you tell us about the history of the creamery and what you guys are all about?
Sure. We started this creamery in 2007, and it really was a dream of one of the partners. And we really wanted to take our milk, because we thought we had some good milk, and make some good cheese with it. And we wanted to model them after European styles. And right now we're making 10 different types of cheeses, and we're working on 11 and 12. One of the first cheeses, as I mentioned, was our Gouda. And then we also made a unpressed monastery style washed rinded cheese. It's called Greenfields.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
And that one too. I mean, there's quite a technique to our cheeses, and there's quite an art to it. It's a lot of hands on. And then we made a Saxony and Alpine style and a pasture's cheddar. And we made those for the first couple of years, and then we started branching out. And we try and hit, you know, a different flavor profile. And, you know, we have a fresh Asiago style. And we have, our newest one, that should be coming out this year. We are making a cheese reminiscent of a French Comté.
Really?
And it's called Ferme Meadows.
I didn't get interested in that. So is that currently aging right now? How long are you going to age that cheese?
It is aging. And this is quite a process, and this kind of helps you understand, you know, the art of this cheese. We've actually been working at it for almost 3 years. This July it'll be 3 years. We work with the, you know, the Center Dairy Research here in Madison on this new cheese, and it took us about a year and a half between the aging and the making, and we really felt like we had the right recipe, and we made our first batch last November, and they're, you know, a good size, a good 20-pound wheel, and we ideally want to age it out about 7-8 months, and it's tasting very good right now.
I'm sure it is. Comté is a good thing to eat.
It is, and you know that too. It's a learning process, and learning our milk. We have it narrowed down. We made that cheese in November, so there's going to be a little extra cream in that cheese. But you want to have a more of a firmer cheese, sort of a little bit drier. And so we understand that we need to make this milk with spring, summer, and fall milk with that cheese. So we'll come into production here very shortly once those cows are out on grass. That's going to add so much character to the milk and so much flavor to the cheese.
You know, so you make a number of cheeses, and one thing I always wonder whenever I talk to cheesemakers is, why do you make that many cheeses? I mean, is it because you have more milk, or because you just want to make new cheeses? Why that many? Like, do you just get interested in other styles of cheese making?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I really like to keep things basic. You know, our first four are four biggest sellers because that's a cheese we've done and we've been able to do it well.
You're talking about Big Ed's, Greenfields.
Yep. Saxony and Pastures.
Saxony and Pastures. You started out with those, and and you branched out from there. The Snope didn't, but was it a need base to branch out, or did you guys just want to?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. The demand is there, and customers are asking for something unique and special, and those two, they are growing in popularity. But again, I agree. Sometimes just keeping it simple, doing what you do well with. But no, we have learned that we need to branch out. So everybody's always looking for that newest cheese. Snowfields actually was sort of an accident because we were making what we thought was Big Ed's and in the winter, but it never tasted like Big Ed's. We couldn't understand it until we started actually breaking down our make sheets, breaking down all our testing, and realized that the cream in Snowfields is over 5% in the wintertime. It's making a completely different cheese.
So bang, suddenly you have one of the top 16 cheeses in the United States.
Our mistake becomes
that's
first
awesome.
Place.
that's the best. that's the best. So there's a fifth Saxon's fifth generation. So what is what's the biggest challenge in maintaining a family farm for that many generations?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question, especially because when from the time that the great-grandpa to now the children of Ed are running this farm has changed. It used to be a confined farm where the cows were in the barns, and they had all their land into crops, to turning full circle, and now all the land is in pastures, and the cows are out. They're rarely confined, only on really bad weather days. It has come full circle. Even when Ed Klesick had the farm, all those cows were all registered Holsteins because that's the cow in Wisconsin. And one of the boys had gone to New Zealand and learned their pasturing system, learning their cows and you know, how do they run their farms over there. And came back with these ideas of, you know what, well, let's turn this into pasture, let's crossbreed our cows, let's get a nice, rich milk. And they ripped up those papers, the registered papers, and they changed the way they're farming. And so now, when you look at it today, what are some of the challenges? I think the family really is going to have some challenges looking for the next generation, that sixth generation coming up.
That's what I mean.
Are they going to take over?
Right. So how do you get the kids to stay on the farm? You know, how do you get them to keep doing that? And because, I mean, there's a lot of other distractions out there. You know, there's a lot of other ways to live. And, I mean, I think that, and then just conjecture, that might be a reason why the family farm is going away, partially. Because maybe the kids don't want to do that because you got to get up at 4 a.m. and go to sleep at midnight, you know, to run the joint. But do you think they're going to go for, are the kids interested over there and still doing it?
I think there's still one in high school. Maybe he'll be the one. But there are two, and there's a couple in grade school yet on the other side, too. There's still a chance. There's a couple that have gone through college, and they have their careers. And but I there's still a chance that the younger ones will still come up. They're there every day. They're feeding calves. I really hope so, because it's a really special farming model. And, you know, they really produce a quality milk and cheese.
Now, see, and then that question is something that I ask, or that I mull over in my head all the time when I'm selling cheese, is, you know, we have a lot of really amazing cheesemakers in America now. But how long are their cheeses going to be being made? You know, are their kids going to do this? And why are people doing it? Why are they making cheese here in the United States? If a family farm is going away and there's a certain generation of Americans that are interested in making cheese, are their kids going to do that? you know? And it's just something I wonder about with cheese. When I go overseas and I visit places where cheese has been being made for 3-4 generations or longer, and I wonder whether or not those kids like want to come to America and live in New York City, you know? They'd be crazy to do that, but do you know what I mean? So it's like, is it a concern for you guys that
I know me personally, it does touch home, because I do feel that even cheese making, the art of making cheese, has changed dramatically. We're really hands-on here, and we have open vats, and we make small batches to another cheesemaker who has closed vats, and it's stainless steel, and they push buttons when things need to happen. So even our younger generation of cheesemakers coming in, they're not necessarily learning the art of making cheese.
Putting their hands
in
the vat.
It touches home, because I think about that here. When I have to hire a cheesemaker, if I have to hire someone for out there, most of the people I'm interviewing don't have experience. And I would just love to see that younger generation, you know, get involved, get your hands in the vat.
What do we do to make that happen?
Oh, that's a good question. I know our state here, they do have the cheesemakers course, and you have to be licensed to be a cheesemaker in Wisconsin. We're one of the only states that does. So I know that they do a fair amount of promoting that here in Wisconsin. Other states, I don't know. That's a good question. I'm not sure.
There's got to be a way. You know, well, we won't let it go away. I mean, I know so many cheesemongers. You know, it's easier to be a cheesemonger than a cheesemaker. We take all your products and your beautiful stuff you make, and we sell it. You know, and you can always find cheesemongers. You know, I think maybe the way is to take cheesemongers and make them eventually into cheesemakers.
I think so.
I think that's the way to go.
I think so. Because they have a passion for what they do, and that's another thing, is just finding people with a passion, because it is a true art form, just like an artist, just like a musician. There's a lot of passion that goes into it, and a lot of your heart and soul go into it.
It's true, but it's also a very process-oriented job. You need some people who are willing to wake up and do the same thing over and over and over again, you know?
Yep.
And that leads me to my last, my last question for you, you know? So with all of the elements, with unstandardized milk, seasonality, all the challenges of maintaining that family farm, how do you guys do so well and create such a consistent product?
Oh, that's a good question. it is, when I look at the cheese that we make, I look at it as an art, and it's there's an artisan process to it, because the more we're doing this, the more we're understanding, the more we're learning. We're understanding our milk, and we're understanding on the farm aspect, what the cows are eating affects the milk that they make, and that also affects the cheese that we make. So it definitely is a learning curve, and we're getting it. We're learning that, our cheese, or our milk, I should say, that comes in, changes from season to season, changes from where the cow is in her lactation. A cow has to have a baby every year, so usually the last 2 months before she calves, she is no longer productive. They don't take any milk from her. So, but when she's late in lactation, she's giving us a really high fat milk. We take that milk in every day. We do some testing on it to see kind of where we're at, and we adapt our recipes to take in whatever nature gives us. So, for instance, let's say our Snowfields, it has a higher fat and protein, more cream is in that milk. We don't standardize, so we don't take off cream and make it all 3%. We just make cheese every day, and we change our recipe. So either we'll stir it out more, We might press the cheese more. We might cut the curd smaller or larger, depending on what's going on with our milk. And it's amazing that our cheesemakers know it. They can have their hand in the vat. They're checking to see if, you know, has the milk coagulated enough? Is it time to cut the curd? And they'll come and they'll say, or they'll call up here in the office and say, what are the fats today? Because they can feel the difference.
That's great. So you got what you know is, you know, good milk makes good cheese. And the good milk is always good, but it's good for different reasons at different times of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what you're telling me here. Well, Lisa, I want to thank you so much for coming on the air today. It's always nice to speak to you. For any of you who have not had Snowfields or any of the great cheeses from Saxon Creamery, you better get out there and try some because they get bought up pretty quick. Stay tuned for another episode next week of Cutting the Curd. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.